What's up, everyone? I'm Joe Pompliano, and this is The Joe Pomp Show. I hope everyone's having a great week so far. I'm super excited about today's episode because it is a conversation between me and Bryson Sullivan. Now, for those of you that don't know Bryson, Bryson is an aerospace engineer, and he's one of the smartest people in and around Formula One. I learn something every time I talk to Bryson, and we had a great conversation that you guys are going to listen to today. Specifically, we talked through the Miami Grand Prix, Lando Norris's first win, Red Bull's pace, and whether some teams could potentially catch up to them over the next few races, Lewis Hamilton going to Ferrari, and whether he is potentially being cut out of communication with the engineers already, Carlos Sainz and what his next move might be, the future of US races, the Audi team, Logan Sargeant, other drivers like that. It's an awesome episode. I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. But before we get into it, let's quickly hear from today's sponsor. Today's episode is sponsored by Doer. Now, Doer is a company that I'm super excited to be working with because I literally wear their product all the time. For those of you that don't know, Doer makes some of the most comfortable and stylish jeans on the market. Someone put me onto their jeans a few months ago, and I've been wearing them ever since. I wear them out to dinner. I wear them while traveling. I wear them while running errands and so many other things too. And the reason specifically why I like Doer over everyone else in the market today is because Doer has done a fantastic job on both style and comfortability. They literally are stretchable. There's breathability. They absorb moisture really well. And I always feel like sometimes you have to decide between one or the other, jeans that look really good or jeans that are super comfortable and stretch. And I feel like Doer has done an incredible job of merging the two together. They fit really well. They don't shrink. They're super fresh and cool and dry. And I wear them, again, literally everywhere. I'll wear them out to sporting events. I'll wear them on date nights. I'll wear them while I'm just hanging around the house or other things like that. So if you guys need a new pair of jeans, go update your wardrobe and get yourself a pair of Doer jeans today. You can either go to their flagship stores in LA or Denver, or you can go online and get 20% off for listening to this podcast through shopdoer.com/pomp. So the way to spell that is shop, S-H-O-P, then doer is doer.com/pomp. Shopdoer.com. Go get your stuff 20% off. All right, Bryson, let's start with the Miami GP. It's so fresh. Lando Norris obviously won his first race in Formula One, broke the Red Bull and I guess Ferrari streak as well, over 500 days of those two teams only winning races. It was awesome. But let's talk about how it happened. So obviously there was a safety car incident and he ended up getting a little bit of an advantage there, but Max still had a decent amount of time to make up the difference, right? And it ended up not really mattering. Was it just pure McLaren had better pace, or was there something wrong with Max's car from the previous incident? I think it lapped like 22, 23, something like that. Just like, what did you see there?
What was so interesting about that situation is that, yes, I mean, Max's car actually probably was damaged. It wasn't actually the bollard itself, but it was the base it was resting on. That the bollard went over his car and the base went under his car. And there is evidence that it did go under the car and potentially damage the floor. But remember, Max has
the base of the bollard, you're saying. It basically chopped it.
It chopped it in half.
And the car ran over the bottom piece. So yeah. The floorboard got messed up.
Yeah, that is what we seem to be saying. And again, you know, Max did not initially believe that in his initial interviews, but after when he actually looked at the car, he says, yeah, there's actually a hole there. But what's interesting is that Max has won races before with a damaged car. I think back to, what was it, Canada, you know, 2023 even, where he had damage from hitting a bird, I think it was. And if there's one thing Max does better than anything is he has metronomic, just immense race pace. And so even though Lando was benefiting from the safety car, I think many of us expected, you know, Max to eventually pass him. That ended up not being the case. But I don't think it's purely a case of just damage from hitting the bollard. And the reason why I say that is because there's a reason why he went off in the first place, right? There's a reason why he was actually struggling on those tires. And then actually it indicates the problem with the way the Red Bull was being handled. What's so funny is that we introduced this rule this year to have Parc Fermé reset after the sprint race to allow teams to make further changes to their car. And initially that was designed to sort of give teams a better chance of getting their ideal pace. It does give you a chance to make improvements to the car, but it also gives you an opportunity to make problems for yourself. Any engineer will tell you that it's just as easy to make things better as it is to make things worse. Often it's much easier to make things worse. And so what's interesting is that even though we usually view the sprint race as just a miniaturized version of what the actual race will be, actually that isn't actually the case, because we're allowing setup changes. And I believe it's kind of the case that whatever setup that Red Bull had for their particular car, it wasn't really as good as it could have been. Now, granted, this is not, you know, Singapore 2022 levels of craziness, or 2023 rather. It wasn't really that bad, but really it's a function of how bad it was.
Is this why we could see something like Ricardo, right? Ricardo, I think he finished fourth in the sprint race, qualified well and performed well. And then when it came to the actual race qualifying, he didn't do well. And obviously the race didn't turn out nearly as well either.
I think it's definitely part of setup, but setup is a function of ambient conditions, right? Track temperature, ambient temperature, how you do your warm-up laps, how much of your emphasis are you putting on qualifying versus the race? Teams make decisions all the time as to how to actually maximize that for their particular car. Regarding Ricardo, it has been a little bit up and down. He certainly has been doing better of late, but things can be taken away just as soon as they come. I would say Lewis Hamilton's race was a good example of that as well. Really didn't have an amazing sprint race. I know there was some controversy over a first lap incident, but I'll steer clear of that for now, especially considering that the two Aston Martins were already crashing before Lewis even entered the frame. But that's a whole other story. but essentially, I mean, once you have the ability to make changes to your car, you open up an entire realm of possibilities to actually learn something. And again, going back to McLaren, I think their pace really was, you know, in large part genuine, precisely because it coincided with a big upgrade package. Now, this is a big upgrade package, and this is the one thing that McLaren seems to be nailing, the other teams don't seem to be nailing, is correlation between what they're seeing in CFD, what they're seeing in the wind tunnel, and actual performance on track. I don't think it's an accident that Lando Norris won the race, and he was the car of the two McLarens that had the full upgrade package.
Yeah, it was last year, right, where McLaren came in, or was it 2 years ago, where they had a really bad car to start with, and then halfway through the year, basically, they were up there with, you know, P2, P3,
P4. It was last year. I know it seems hard to believe, but I think...
It seems so long ago, yeah.
this time last year, if I remember correctly, the two McLarens finished 17th and 19th at the Miami GP. I mean, it is just a world of difference, and when you go back and think about how much better they've become through identifiable upgrades. I mean, Austria, you know, last year was just transformative, and they've kept that performance going forward. Even if they haven't started the season quite as good as they would have liked to this year, this upgrade seems to be a real deal. Now, to be clear, yes, team principals will say Max had damage and there's no problem. And, you know, another team principal will say our upgrades are phenomenal. Of course, we're going to make it. The stopwatch never lies. Okay, team principals occasionally do. So the real judgment of whether or not this pace change that we saw is real is going to be Imola. We're going to have to see. It's a very different type of track, a lot of straight lines and hard braking zones. So it rewards different performance aspects of the car than Miami does. So circuit specific things will matter. But for sure, we'll know a lot more about how real that pace is in Imola.
Yeah. Speaking of tracks, has your opinion of Miami's track changed at all over the last few years?
So as a Florida native, someone who grew up in South Florida and is absolutely obsessed with Formula One, first of all, let me say it is extremely heartening for me to not only see a good Formula One race in Miami, but the race that we had on Sunday was objectively great, but also seeing Formula One trying to make a stronger effort to invest in the community, to try to empower kids to learn more about STEM and engineering and using Formula One as a tool to do that. That's something that is really positive for me. But on the flip side, we also have the problem with Miami being hyper expensive to the average person. Yeah. And for me, my obsession with Formula One started... It was engendered by being in the presence of Formula One cars racing. And on a random Sunday, my friends just dragged me along to go see these amazing cars. And without that, I wouldn't be as invested in it as I am now. I fear that the Miami track, as much as I love it and as much as I'm happy that it's developing, there isn't an opportunity for a young kid who isn't saving a lot of money to just go to a racetrack and see Formula One cars for the first time. I feel like there's a niche there that in the old days, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway gave to me that I wish we could open up in the Miami GP to have a slightly lower barrier to entry financially.
Yeah, Indy's amazing. I've been there a number of times, and you can, I mean, the ticket prices are, again, objectively cheaper than certainly Miami, but you can walk right down to the fence and you can, you know, see how fast these cars are going in real time, and it really blows you away. And I think to your point, probably gives young kids an appreciation for the sport that they may not have otherwise. And I think Miami has done, you know, they learn every year, right? The first year, I've been 3 years in a row now. And the first year, it was kind of a mess, right? Like there was no signs anywhere. You didn't know where to go. There was like, it was just kind of felt like put together. And I always tell people, I went, I think 2 weeks before the race, or maybe even a little bit less, they had the Miami Open there. And I was living in Miami at the time. And we went to the tennis tournament, and I walked around just the outside because I knew the race was going to be happening in 10 days or so. And I thought to myself, there's no way they're going to be holding a race. There was nothing up. There was no grandstands up. There was nothing. And credit to them, right? They figured it out. But I think what I noticed is this year in particular, everything was set up a month and a half beforehand. So like infrastructure wise, I think they've learned a lot and they're doing better. And now it's about delivering a slightly better fan experience, right? I think for people that can afford it, the race is great because the packages are awesome. It's super luxurious, but it feels like there should be maybe like a, you know, $25, $50 daily pass where you can go in. And even if you don't have the best seat in the house, at least get close enough to the cars where you can see them and hear them and feel kind of how fast they're going.
I was also there in 2022, so I know firsthand what you're talking about. One thing I would say is, again, one of the benefits that the Miami GP has over other places is that it takes advantage of the infrastructure of a stadium itself. So the entire Hard Rock Stadium is essentially general admission. So even if you don't have a designated seat in a grandstand, you actually can sit in the stadium and enjoy a DJ show or have some food. And that's a really positive thing. I love the echoes of the sound of the cars going off the walls there. It's really fun. And I actually really love some of the corners at the Miami GP. Turn four, the apex of turn four, you can stand right next to it. It's fantastic. I've been there. It's an amazing corner. The one thing I think that Miami should take a serious look at is considering, not mandating, but considering the idea of shifting the race to twilight or to actually being a night race. And I say that for two reasons. One is just the heat exhaustion that fans experience going to the race. Now, granted, if you're in the VIP section and you have spray and fans going all the time and you're living in the lap of luxury, surely. But for the everyday person sitting out there and walking outside in the grandstand, it's extraordinarily hot. And it would be fantastic if we could hold the race a little bit later in the day, so the temperatures are a little bit better. And also, you know, kind of for the engineers as well, it helps them plan their races better. The tires aren't overheating as much. I mean, some of the same arguments we've had historically for why Bahrain works so much better as a night race would also apply to Miami. Of course, there's a geographical challenge with having a night race or a twilight race in Miami. It's not going to be ideal for the European market. But my response to that is Formula One is a global sport, and a global sport has to act like a global sport sometimes. And sometimes that means that your biggest demographic, you know, in the UK and in that area, sometimes has to be up at, you know, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning like we are. Now, again, that's the vast majority of the time.
I agree. And I wish you were there to back me up when I said that for Las Vegas, because I said basically the same thing, right? Like we wake up at 2, 3, 4 in the morning to watch races all the time. And Europe can do it once, right? Like if it happens maybe once, maybe twice, it's not the worst thing in the world. But the feedback was always just, you know, there's 3 million people watching in the United States where there's potentially 100 million people watching elsewhere, and that's who they need to cater for.
But there is a caveat there as well, because you have to remember it's actually harder to be a Formula One fan in North America and South America simply because of the time differences. So there are plenty of people who would love to watch a race live in the US but just don't, because they don't want to get up at certain ungodly hours, especially on the West Coast. So the numbers themselves, they certainly are there, and I'm not contesting them in an objective sense. Just trying to add a bit of context to what we might actually see. And again, these are our considerations for the future. I have my own reasons for suggesting them, but these are my suggestions.
Well, and the flip side of that is that if Formula One's main goal, which it appears to be, right, is grow the business from an economic perspective and a financial perspective, the US market, I would argue, is much more lucrative than international markets, specifically across Europe and other places like that, from TV rights and everything else. So maybe you sacrifice some in the short term, but if you're able to build that fan base, that's phenomenal. And I think we saw it. One of my favorite things about Formula One is that they actually gave the TV rights to ESPN when they first came to the US for free. They literally said, just broadcast it and you guys can do it for free. And what that did was it put it on a major network where everyone knew where to find it. And it grew the audience. It doubled, tripled over, you know, 3-4 years. And now they have a base, but I think they need to continue to do more work. And I think it also goes back. People ask me all the time if Max's dominance is kind of ruining that a little bit. And maybe it is, but I've been quite happy with kind of the cost cap itself and what it's done over the last few years, in my opinion, at least for the midfield teams, and tightening things up a little bit there. But I'm curious to hear your opinion on kind of the effect of that so far.
I mean, the one thing I will never do is deride someone for being excellent, right? I will certainly critique Max and his wheel-to-wheel shenanigans, but his doing what he's done with his car has really been fantastic. And the thing is, it takes more than a fast car to win the way he has. I've stood by for too many years people complaining about Lewis Hamilton winning, and he only wins because he has the fastest car and everything. It's just, it was nonsense then, and it's nonsense now. You have to give someone credit for actually doing what he's doing. That being said, in terms of how the cost cap is working, the cost cap is a really good idea. Actually, I think it was actually Otmar Szafnar, believe it or not, who was actually the architect of that idea to begin with. The challenge is Formula One teams employ some of the most brilliant and tactical financial people in the world, and they will find every possible way to stretch each dollar to its moral and legal limit, you know, especially with people working half-time and things like this. And so my suggestion has always been keep the same architecture of having a sliding scale with the best team being most disadvantaged and the worst team being the most advantaged. But instead of using money, I actually would say use a sliding scale on the minimum weight of the cars, right? And the reason why I say that is because you can't argue with physics. You can't outsmart physics. You know, 10 kilograms is going to be roughly 3/10 of a second per lap, period. It doesn't matter how good your people are. That weight is going to be there. And because we have that weight effect quantitatively so precisely, we can choose a weight that kind of makes sense. But in broad terms, set things exactly where they are now based on championship order, maybe even reset it once in the middle of the year, and then once at the end of the year. But basically, it's a success balance. The team that creates the fastest car will have the highest minimum weight limit. And the team that has the slowest car will have the slowest minimum, the lightest minimum weight limit. And that still leaves room for creativity. It still leaves room for engineering, ingenuity, and finding creative technological solutions to these problems. Because even if you have extra weight on your car, where you place that weight relative to the center of gravity is very important for the handling and the dynamics of the car. There's all kinds of ways in which you can figure out a way to express yourself as a creative and technical powerhouse as a top-running team. But it would be much easier for the field to be closer. Now, just to be clear, we are actually experiencing one of the closest fields in the history of Formula One, but that's in terms of absolute lap time. It's not close in terms of a variety of success. We still have the same major players pretty much every race, and that's part of the reason why Miami was so special, was because it was the exception that showed, you know, what that rule has actually been over the past couple of years. So I'm excited to see what the future holds. I hope we don't have any more changes in the regulations up until 2026. Then we have the big change, because it turns out that sometimes the most exciting seasons of Formula One don't come from a huge regulation change, because one team just gets it right and everyone else gets it wrong. It really comes from pure stability of regulations, so that everyone can kind of catch up and get to the same point, and then, you know, really have a fight on in terms of absolute pace.
I love that. I like that idea a lot, because it almost makes the engineering side of things a little bit more creative, because they have to work with different weights versus other teams, right? And it speaks to how well they can actually engineer the car versus kind of everyone being on an even playing field to some degree with the money.
And one small caveat I will say, yeah. I know people are going to say this is too much like BOP, like in WEC, and they're changing things every race. What I will say is I don't like the politics in sport. I don't want lobbying to be the reason why a team is being given extra weight. What I would like to see is only adjust this twice and only based on championship order. That's it. No track by track specific stuff.
I like that. Let's talk about Lewis, Mercedes, George. Lewis is obviously leaving for Ferrari at the end of the year. Are we at the point now where he's kind of like cut off of communication with kind of future stuff?
I imagine he's remarkably close to that point if he's not already past it. And that's a difficult situation to be in. I don't think historically we've had a driver change telegraphed so far ahead. And a full season of driving for a team when you know you're not going to be driving for them before, maybe we've seen a team want to change drivers, but not the driver changing teams. That's a radical shift in dynamic on its own. But Lewis is in a very interesting place. I can imagine a time when after his spirited battle with Kevin Magnussen, he would be fuming. He would be throwing up all kinds of things and complaining in a general sense, but he was loving it. He was just enjoying the battle. He's like, hey, you know, fair enough. You're going to break the rules deliberately. That's kind of a interesting choice on its own. But he seemed to not be as mad as many of us expected him to be, or even that we were, you know, just watching him race. And at the same time, I feel like he's trying to be more deliberate about being a mentor to the younger drivers in the generation, Lando, of course, being there, but also George. I mean, yes, George has had antagonistic streaks with Lewis in his short time, but George is going to be the new leader of Mercedes very soon. And I imagine that Lewis is trying his best to pass on some information that might be helpful, because George is going to be the new person, new front man, to run experiments and give good feedback to the team. And I mean, the only scenario in which that wouldn't be the case is if somehow Max Verstappen ends up in Mercedes next year, which I strongly doubt, because the car is not competitive enough to attract him. But yes, Lewis is probably being cut off from engineering meetings, but I think they're just doing their best to try to navigate the situation. And I'm very excited for next year, not only for Lewis and Ferrari, but maybe even Mercedes as well, depending on who they get to take Lewis's seat.
And where do you feel the Mercedes car is at right now, right? Because as someone who loves the sport and watches a lot, but doesn't follow the day-to-day engineering stuff as much, it feels like Lewis is always experimenting with something or trying something out. And there's always like, it makes it difficult to determine kind of like which drivers are performing better in some instances without looking at the data, because, you know, you'll see George out-qualify him, you know, 4 or 5 races. And you're like, oh, Lewis isn't performing that well. And then you come back in from the garage and he's like, we had a totally different setup. I was doing this. He was doing this. And it just seems like he's been a lot more open to that than certainly George, but maybe other drivers too. Is that kind of your feel?
I mean, this is in some sense a voluntary thing to run experiments with your car. It's not always a team pushing it. Sometimes it's a driver pushing it. And regardless of who is doing it, it's always a sign of desperation.
I saw, actually, Bryson, real quick, did you ever watch the interview with James Vowles on High Performance Podcast?
I am aware of it. I'm not sure I've seen the whole thing.
You should watch it. He talks about what makes each driver different, right? And he talks about Nico, he talks about Lewis, he talks about Schumacher. And one of the things I thought was really interesting about that conversation was he talks about Lewis specifically when it comes to testing. And he says Lewis will test things like no other driver he's ever seen. He says it'll drive engineers crazy because they'll have a specific plan and they'll tell him to go do it on a track. By lap one, he knows everything about the track already, whereas some drivers maybe take 5, 6, 7, 8 laps to get comfortable with the track. Lewis is good in lap one, and then he's changing buttons all over the wheel. and he said that, again, it drives some engineers crazy because they have a whole plan and they think they know based on tests and data and all of that. But then he'll find something sometimes and he'll just like intuitively know with the car because he's driven so many different cars over the years. And he felt like that was one of the things that made Lewis one of the best drivers ever versus some other guys who have different strengths and weaknesses versus Lewis.
I can definitely understand individual drivers having their own proclivities in terms of how willing they are to experiment with a car. But in general, if you're off the pace and you're just trying to find a way to get a big result, because of the nonlinear nature of the point system, if you get one big result, that sometimes can count for more than several small results. So the desire to continue pushing, to continue experimentation, either driven by the team or driven by the driver, is really a sign of the team not really being where it needs to be. And really, historically speaking, there are really two things that Mercedes really struggled with. One is aerodynamic efficiency, which is to say the rate at which the downforce increases with drag, where the penalty is drag. So the rate at which the drag increases with downforce is too high. So you can hit the downforce target you're trying to reach, but you have so much drag on the straights that it nullifies the point. You want to have high downforce and reasonably low drag, which is something that the Red Bull car excels at. But something else that the Red Bull car excels at and has done so for almost the entire time of this new regulation set is that it has a very wide operating window. seems to be able to run at a range of ride heights, a range of tire pressures, cambers, all kinds of interesting things, different track surface temperatures. It seems to just want to work over. There's a practicality to its design that I think is really one of the signature characteristics of a Nui car, which is that it has to work over a wide range of conditions. And that's the exact opposite of Mercedes's car. They will be faster than greased lightning in FP1, and they'll make a subtle change to the car to get a little bit better in that direction. Or sometimes they won't even change the car, but the track conditions will change, and suddenly it's out of the window and it's nowhere. I mean, it's just a challenging situation to be in. But at the end of the day, if you have better tools and better correlation between the tools and what's going on track, it becomes easier to actually design certain characteristics into a car, such as a wide operating window. So it's definitely a challenge, but it's something that cannot be, this problem was not created overnight, so it cannot be fixed overnight.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Yeah, it seems like it's more challenging than they probably initially assumed it would be to fix, considering we have teams like McLaren, who, to your point, were, you know, 17th, 18th, whatever it was last year, and are now arguably, you know, the second fastest team on the grid. If you look at Mercedes, I think on pace they were fourth right yesterday. So
and that was a great day. That was a very good day.
Yeah. Yeah. Lewis had a number of overtakes that, you know, watching live were really, really impressive. Yeah. And sometimes it looked like he was really struggling with the car too, which makes it even more impressive. But when he makes a move to, so when he announces he's going to Ferrari, I feel like there probably has to be an assumption of some sort that he knows something behind the scenes about the direction of the car or where they think that they'll be headed, maybe 2025, but particularly probably 2026. Is that fair to say in your opinion?
I think we can never know for certain how things are going to be. We know what each individual team is going to bring to the table, how they believe they're going to perform, the identifiable factors that they can say, hey, we're going to have a good chassis, we're going to have a good engine, we're going to have a good wind tunnel. But you don't know what your competitors are doing. So even in the best case scenario, even if you've been told everything in the world by a team principal trying to lure you to the dark side, you don't know for sure. And so certainly Lewis was told certain things that made him, you know, want to make the change on top of the things going on at Mercedes. Again, there are pull factors in addition to push factors. I think the elephant in the room here is whether or not Lewis knew about Adrian Newey's plans to leave Red Bull. If anyone knew about it, Lewis would know. And if the destination team for Adrian Newey is in fact Ferrari, Lewis would know because Fred would know. And that would absolutely be arguably the ultimate, you know, pull factor. Think of it this way. Everything Lewis Hamilton has achieved in his entire career, the most successful racing driver of all time, he has done without Adrian Newey. Imagine what he could do with Adrian Newey. I mean, that's just, even some of the great champions, I would say, of the recent era, you know, Vettel, you know, Verstappen, Newey cars, you know, they have not won championships without Adrian Newey. So it's I mean, of course, you need more than a fast car to win a championship, as I've already said. But it's an interesting point of comparison to make. I'm very curious to see how Ferrari manifests itself in 2026. They have assembled a small army of engineers and technical people and are seemingly poised to land the greatest technical mind in the history of the sport by most people's accounts. Now, granted, Adrian has said that he's taking some time off and he's taking a break and we don't know where he's going.
So I heard that, right? He said something along the lines of like, you know, it'd be like leaving my family. I'm going to take some time off. I need, you know, I'm tired. But it feels weird that he lined up the negotiated basically garden leave to start now, really, while he's still with the team working on other projects, and end next year so he can influence the following year's car. Like that just, you know, it lines up too perfectly for that to not be something else.
When you think about who Adrian Newey is, or what he represents and what he can do, the fact that he could potentially work for another Formula One team besides Red Bull next year is actually insane. It's actually incredible. There were some incredible maneuverings and legal machinations going on behind the scenes to be able to actually get him to do that. And I suspect that Red Bull is getting some things from him in order to do that, especially working on the RB17 hypercar. But I also suspect that Red Bull is also getting a PR layer to this as well from Adrian. And I'm sure that's something he hates to do because he just wants to design race cars and not get involved. But the fact that he will be attending select F1 races to give input at various times, and he also is doing all these things. I can't speak for what is actually going on there, but if I had to guess, if I were a betting person, I would say that his public statements are very calculated and they're based on behind the scenes things.
There seems to be a lot of kind of maneuvering going on in careful language, right? Because if you hear Zach Brown, for instance, he's saying that there's resumes and CVs flying all over the place, and he thinks there's more shoes to fall or drop. And if you're a Red Bull fan or you listen to the team, a lot of them would say that they have a great technical staff in place, that Adrian Newey only spends about 50% of his time on Formula One anyways anymore. He's been building, you know, submarines and hypercars and other things like that. And the Formula One team is going to be fine. And maybe that's true, but I think it's kind of addition on the other side, right? Of like, if another team was to get a mind like Adrian Newey, how much is that worth compared to the team that he's been at for a decade plus losing him? Maybe losing him isn't as big because he's trained a lot of the people underneath him and they have a good team in place. But getting him, I think, is incredibly more valuable than losing him. And it seems like something Lewis would, if you know it is going to happen, would certainly know ahead of time.
Yeah, and again, the contribution of an individual to a racing car, again, it's nonlinear. You could spend 5% of your time working on a car, but if the precise advice you give is era defining in terms of figuring out what the car should do, I'll give you a perfect example. You know, in 2023, there was this question about how do you fix this porpoising issue the cars have been experiencing? Let's raise the floor edges and the coordinate system of the car to make the porpoising issue less of a deal. Red Bull was initially very opposed to this idea because they felt at the end of 2022, they had a car that handled porpoising very, very well. We don't want to give up our competitive advantage, they would say, you know, by making this concession in the regulations. But in fact, it seems like, and this is something that I think it was Glenn Freeman at the race pointed out, there's an interview where Adrian Newey was actually mentioned specifically with Red Bull saying, actually, believe it or not, this floor change could actually help us address a deficiency in our high-speed cornering that we have. Again, they were still winning almost everything in 2022, but believe it or not, this floor change could actually benefit them more than hurt them for 2023. And, you know, we saw how 2023 went. So just imagine if you didn't have that hand on the tiller, so to speak, of the ship guiding you. Imagine if they had fought that regulation tooth and nail and suddenly lost their competitive advantage that they thought they had because it exposed another area of the performance of the car. You just can't really put a price on that kind of advice. The thing I say about Adrian Newey is he knows the answers to questions that they haven't even thought to ask yet.
Yeah.
And that's something you can't really put a price on.
Yeah. One question that I'm curious to have you answer is I get asked a lot from people that aren't hardcore Formula One fans, right? Maybe they watch a couple of races or they're new to the sport. And they always ask what the difference is between Max and Checo, right? Why, if they have the same car, if the equipment's all the same, why one is so much better than the other? And it's easy to say that one's a better driver, right? I think most people would agree at this point that Max is superior talent-wise maybe than Checo is. But one of the things I heard a while back, and it's the simplest way I can explain it to people who are not into the technical side of things, is I think it was Alex Albon talking about it and why he struggled so much in that car versus Max. And he likened it to playing Call of Duty. And he said on sensitivity, if you go and you play on Call of Duty, Max likes it a 12 out of 10, right? Like he wants it as sensitive as it can possibly be. And a lot of other drivers aren't used to that. And you may say, okay, the car is built around Max, if that's what you want to consider, but there's arguments to be made that maybe that's where the car is the fastest and Max is able to adapt to it more. How do you explain kind of that delta between a driver like Max and someone else on his team, whether it's, you know, Checo or someone else?
Yeah. So this is why I love driving. We were talking offline about how I went karting yesterday and I'm still kind of sore from it, but actually getting behind the wheel of a car and experiencing those vehicle dynamics firsthand gives you some insight into how different drivers actually drive the cars. I mean, speed is not universal in the same way that like genius is not universal. There's this old trope in Hollywood that a genius is just a genius and they're a genius in everything. So if they're good at math, if they're good at science and they're good at poetry and they're good at everything, they're just good at everything. But in reality, most people are kind of particular to a given area. I mean, I'm terrible at like doctor stuff. Like if you ask me to memorize bones, you're going to be in trouble, buddy. But I can tell you about thermodynamics. You know, we can talk about that. Driving styles are kind of the same way. And not only that, but Nui's cars specifically are designed to exploit every possible way in which the car can perform. And they are on the limit in every sense of the word, sometimes mechanically, sometimes aerodynamically. David Coulthard, in qualifying last year, retold a story of his time with Adrian Newey. And Adrian was telling him to, as he was going around the corner, don't use as much steering angle because the wake from the front tires is actually a very prominent aerodynamic feature of Formula One cars. And the more you increase the yaw angle of the car and the steering angle of the wheel together, the bigger the wake becomes and the more it affects the downstream elements of the car and it robs you of downforce. So David was trying to grapple with the idea of how to steer around a corner without steering. Right. And that sounds like a paradoxical thing to do, but it was what was required of Adrian Newey's car to get 10 tenths out of it and actually drive it to the limit of grip. And not only that, but at least in the previous regulation cycle, you know, 2021 and before, seemed to be a lot of longitudinal migration of the center of pressure of Adrian Newey's cars under braking. You know, he used to drive these cars with very, very high rake angle. They're very lean at the front and up at the rear. It creates a beautiful suction peak at the lip of that floor. Get a lot of hard suction, but, you know, it can cause a lot of migration as the car dives under braking. The aero bounds can change quite a lot. And so you have to be able to drive around that peculiar nature, that peculiar characteristic of the car to actually get the maximum out of it. So again, all the drivers that you see, Alex Albon, you know, Logan Sargeant, Nicholas Latifi, they are better than 99.99% of human beings at driving race cars. It's just that last tenth of a percent that really is separating the great drivers from the simply excellent. So I
didn't hear you say Mazepin.
Mazepin's like a 98th percentile. he is a professional racing driver. Look, if you get paid to race cars, you are a professional racing driver. I will never take that away from him. But, you know, I don't have anything else to add about that. But in all seriousness, though, driving is a complex art. And it requires different things from different people and different cars. I mean, one of the things that great champions don't get enough credit for is actually adapting to new cars every year. Yes, if they are the dominant driver, the car will try to be guided towards them, but sometimes there's regulation changes and they have to relearn how to actually get the most out of that particular car.
So it's fair to say that Max is better at adapting to that than maybe anyone else, you know, certainly on the grid, but
I mean, there's definitely some convergence between the way he likes his cars to be driven and the way Newey designs his cars to be driven.
Yeah.
That's sort of a serendipitous thing that probably is never going to happen again because Newey's leaving the team. So we don't know how well Max will do it in other cars. I mean, when you think about Max, he was always a good kind of driver, even in the lower formulas. And when he was driving for Toro Rosso, he was quite good. But the second you put him in an Adrian Newey designed car, I mean, he won immediately. Granted, the Mercedes had to take each other out. But he was there to take advantage of that situation. And that's evidence that you could tell right away that he was where he needed to be in terms of the car design.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Carlos Sainz. So Ferrari's now in a unique spot where They know Carlos is leaving the team at the end of the year. Lewis is coming in. Carlos has been very quick. He's put on a number of performances over the last year, even. I imagine he's now going to be getting shut out of engineering meetings too, similar to how Lewis would be at Mercedes, because, you know, he's leaving the team and could potentially go somewhere else. Do you have any predictions on where you think he'll end up?
If rumors are to be believed, he will not be going to Audi/Sauber. That seems to have been the trade for being a very lucrative deal, but in a car that's not going to be competitive enough for him. His other options would be Mercedes and probably Red Bull itself. And again, given the magnitude of Newey's move from Red Bull, anything is actually on the table. Now, however unlikely we may think it might be for Max to leave Red Bull, it's not an impossible thing to happen. But more likely, Max would stay, and maybe Red Bull has decided that Checo is his time is done at Red Bull, and perhaps times would be a better option. If I was Red
Bull, I kind of feel bad for Checo, because every year he's like sitting there and they're just constantly talking about someone taking his seat specifically.
There's two reasons they're doing that. One is they believe, this is kind of the morality of this, you can judge for yourself. They believe he performs better when he is under pressure and doesn't have a contract. So they will deliberately slow walk his contract to try to get more out of him. Now you can argue if that's a good decision or not, or what it means about how they view him, but okay. But the other thing is Checo's a good driver, but he's shown some weaknesses recently. Not once, but twice this weekend, he's almost run into Max on the first corner. And when he almost ran into Max in the actual race, I gasped. I was sure he was going to take him out. I was sure of it. I mean, I'm confident that you could not fit a paper between Checo's front wing and Max's wheel. I think Max even himself was wide-eyed when he saw it in the cool-down room. But no, I think Sergio Perez is a good driver, but Carlos Sainz would be, at this point, might be a better option for Red Bull. Sainz is too good a driver to not be anywhere, but at the same time, by not accepting the Audi drive, again, if that's true, we don't know, but by not accepting the Audi drive, he is taking a risk. He's either going to benefit from this and get into a competitive car immediately, which is really what he wants, or it could backfire spectacularly, and worst case scenario, he could be off of the grid. That didn't have to be the case. You know, he could have taken the Audi deal. But he just
was the Audi deal an expiring offer? Is that the rumor?
It seems to be an expiring offer, and it seems to be that it wasn't so much that he said I will never drive for you. He just seemingly didn't
wants more time to find out if there's a competitive car he can get into.
And didn't he want for his own reasons wanted to wait more time? And if Audi, you know, wants to play the game, they can do that, or they can say we have our own objectives. If you don't want to drive for us, then we'll just find someone else. And so they already have Hülkenberg, and maybe Valtteri Bottas wants a guaranteed seat. Maybe Zhou does. We don't know. So this has been one of the silly seasons that's ever sillied in my mind.
Yeah. How many – aren't there a number of – like isn't like half the grid contract after this year?
Not only that. Well, more than half the grid, actually.
More than half,
but
yeah.
Not only that, there are these swirling rumors constantly, even as of right now. We've already witnessed Logan Sargeant's last race, and that he'll be replaced by Kimi Antonelli and Imola. I don't know how true that is, but wow.
Toto says no, right?
Well, like I said, team principals are not obligated to tell the truth. They're obligated to do what's best for the team at the moment. So who knows?
Yeah, that's fair. Speaking of Kimi, what's Kimi's story? He's like supposed to be the most talented driver since Max.
Yes, that is the intention. And remember, you know, Mercedes and Toto Wolff wanted Max originally, but they couldn't sign him when the opportunity came, because they had, you know, Nico Rosberg and Lewis Hamilton. And one of the unspoken benefits of Red Bull having a second team is they can just put their young drivers in that team. No problem. No fuss. No anything. And give them a path to Formula One to get that valuable experience. And that's something other teams cannot do. So Toto is probably very cognizant of that loss of Verstappen earlier on. He does not want to miss out on that opportunity again, because Verstappen is objectively a great driver in many aspects. Again, wheel-to-wheel racing needs to show some more respect, I would say. But you can't argue about his pace. He's extremely fast. So I do believe that in terms of what Kimi is going to be exposed to, they will get him, Mercedes family, will get him into a car as quickly as possible. Whether it's a Mercedes in 2025, probably not, but maybe. But if it isn't that, it probably will be Williams, because they probably...
But Williams, they'd probably want him for multiple years, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it could be the case. I mean, this is something that could actually work for Carlos Sainz as well. Because if Carlos Sainz says, listen, what if I drive for Mercedes for 2 years? More than a one-year deal, but 2 years. That gives him enough time to still be sort of in the competitive area, but also gives him time to see how Audi's actually performing in 2026, see if they have any real skill, and then actually give Kimi Antonelli time to get a little bit more experience under his belt, because he's been rushed through the system at an incredible pace. And so fundamentally, I think that could be something that could potentially work. If it was 2 years for Antonelli at Williams, 2 years for Sainz at Mercedes, that's a possible thing. But personally, I'd rather see Sainz at Red Bull. He and Max would have some very interesting fights together.
I would love to see that. And he grew up in the Red Bull system, right? So he's got familiarity there, whether, you know, he wants to do that again against Max or not. But yeah. I also assume it's kind of a challenging environment going into a team like that, where you know that, you know, Max is the number one. It's not going to be up for debate if Carlos is there.
Yeah, but that's why I respect people who go into someone else's team. I mean, I respect Lewis for at this stage in his career. He's not the spring chicken anymore. He's an older guy, a statesman of the sport, as it were. To go into someone else's team, Charles Leclerc's team, specifically Ferrari, and expect to be competitive and not shy away from that challenge, I think it deserves more respect than it probably gets. And so I think Lando was heavily approached by Red Bull and decided maybe he didn't want to be at Red Bull because it was going to be Max's team. So going into someone else's team is something that's not easy to do. And I think we should sort of celebrate it more.
Where McLaren is his team.
Right. Right. McLaren is very much his team. Although Piastri is definitely a very strong teammate. He validated his decision almost immediately going to McLaren. All that being said, I think Ocon did score Alpine's first points this last race. So good for him.
Why did Alpine take such a drop back, such a step back?
It is strange, isn't it? But the number one thing I know for sure they had a problem with was weight. And as I said, you can't argue with physics. It doesn't matter how good your engine is. It doesn't matter how good your aerodynamics is. If your car is overweight, it's going to be slow. And it seems strange that in a third year of regulations that a car could actually be over the weight limit. But the biggest challenge is that teams are trying to go in the other direction, get the weight down as far as they can, and get very marginal structurally on the nose, on other areas. And seemingly they didn't pass the first crash test. And so you have to make changes to the car to make sure it does pass the crash test. And by its very nature, it's going to add weight.
What is your opinion of Pierre Gasly as a driver? And the reason I ask this, right, is because it seems like he's talented, right? He's I think, shown that a number of times that he can be a good driver for a good team. But his career has kind of taken like a weird arc now, right? Of where he was, you know, at AlphaTauri, he went to Red Bull. He didn't perform in Red Bull. He got sent back down. He eventually wanted to leave AlphaTauri because it felt like he was kind of trapped to some degree, I imagine. He goes to Alpine. They were a competitive team, and now they've kind of slid down the pack a little bit. And now he is essentially kind of irrelevant for like a top team to a degree of like, where he is on an everyday weekend, right? He's not up there. He's not competitive. And it feels like his career, where he showed promise early on, has kind of taken a step back because of it.
I think he definitely still has fight in him. He definitely has the racer's mentality, the killer instinct, you know, in him. But this is Formula One. You know, the car is 90% of your performance. And it's like Martin Brundle used to say, you can't pick the car up and carry it around the track. You have to have a fundamentally good package underneath you to be able to perform. Now, granted, you know, when he went to Alpine, that was looking like a far more competitive option. He had the opportunity to form the all-French super team, you know, with Esteban Ocon, and it's going. But I wouldn't say his recent struggles are a reflection of him personally as much as they're a reflection of the whirlwind of change going on at Alpine. I can't tell you how frequently they change management and fire people and hire people. The turnover at the team is at an all-time high. They need to find some stability in their management, and I think the performance of the car will eventually reflect that.
Yeah, so I think that's more what I was saying, right? It's not the idea that he struggled as a driver, but he picked a team that has struggled, and that's had an impact on his performance and maybe his career and the trajectory of his career, whereas he was one of the more desirable drivers on the market. He still may be from a skill perspective, right, to some people, but from a performance perspective and a results perspective, that's probably changed to a degree.
You can always rehabilitate your driving career if you have the right drive. Nico Hülkenberg has proven that. He seemingly has parlayed a super reserve role into an actual race seat and now a lucrative deal with Audi, but yeah, it clearly can happen and you just need the right circumstances.
Yeah. Last couple of questions. Do you think that Daniel Ricciardo is driving in 2026 in Formula One?
Yes, I do. I think that the coincidence with the chassis change and his better performances, whether it's a real physical engineering change or it's just the placebo effect, I feel like I'm doing better now and that results in him driving better. The human body is a complex system. Sometimes, performance isn't always linked to hard numbers, but he's definitely driving better. If he continues at this pace, he will definitely be on the grid in 2025 and 2026.
Is that a real thing that sometimes it's just kind of in the mindset of the driver with the chassis rather than actual performance related things?
Sometimes you can feel like you're completely exhausted. You can feel like you've got nothing left to give, but actually you're right on the edge of an incredible threshold of performance. Again, as I mentioned before, I did probably 2.5 hours of karting yesterday. And at the end of the sixth or the fifth race, I was like, look, I'm just getting slower and slower. I'm not hitting the corner as fast as I want to because it's hurting. It's hurting to take the corner at full speed at this point. I'm tired. I'm an old man now. But then I went back after the races and I was looking at my actual session on session improvement. And I was getting faster every time. Even though I was feeling terrible, I was still actually gaining lap time. So sometimes we can be poor witnesses to our own kind of subjective experience, and how that translates onto on-track performance is a function of how we're feeling about ourselves. And it's complicated. I'm not going to pretend to understand it.
Okay. All right. Last two questions. Does anyone else outside of Red Bull, or I guess we'll include Ferrari in that, anyone outside of Red Bull or Ferrari win a race this year?
Well, we've already got the big ones out of the way, right? We've already gotten Ferrari. We've already gotten McLaren. Who are the other people that could possibly do it? Mercedes? Nah, probably not. Aston Martin? They've gone backwards.
All right. Will Ferrari, I guess I'm asking, will McLaren win a race for the rest of the year?
Yeah. I think it's possible for McLaren to win again. I also think it's possible for Ferrari to win again. Yeah. It probably will require a bit more of a struggle from Red Bull, something along the lines of a mechanical problem that ends their race early, or a first lap crash, or a beneficial safety car. But
so not on pure pace.
I'm not sure yet. I mean, it's such a bizarre situation because Max has been so good in Nui's cars. They perform at such a high level. It's difficult to really believe they're having problems. I mean, we think about how close the racing was in Miami. Imagine what would happen if Red Bull was more conservative with their RB20 design. We saw how aggressive they were being, a totally new engine cover, radical new inlet and cooling system, and like crazy boundary layer suction things. I mean, all kinds of crazy stuff going on with their car. Imagine if they were just not as radical. They would have been caught by now easily. So I think it's definitely the case that this year's Red Bull is not as dominant as last year's Red Bull is, despite the upgrades. And because of that, I think the likelihood of a non-Red Bull winning another race is actually pretty high.
Okay. That'd be entertaining. All right. Last question is U.S. races. Let's say 2028. Do we have a fourth U.S. race at the time? And if so, where do you think it'll be?
Three races in the United States has always seemed to me like the right fit, the natural fit, because it covers all three time zones, right? I mean, again, the world at large sometimes has a difficult time understanding how vast the area of the United States actually is. It's huge. And to be able to actually go to races, three actually is a good spread. I feel like we are geographically covered right now. So personally, I don't really want a fourth race, or if we do, I'm happy to do a biannual type of period where we're cycling through races every couple of years instead of every single year. But I don't have to guess, because Formula One already made clear they want to have a race in Chicago. They'd like to have another street race. And so
the trademarks, was that real?
My understanding is that it's real. Yeah.
Yeah. So they purchased or registered the trademarks for Chicago Grand Prix.
And again, that's not a guarantee that's going to happen. It just means,
but they're protecting themselves.
It means that plans are things are happening behind the scenes to keep doors open that might otherwise close.
Yeah, that'd be entertaining. I don't know which one they would kick out. It probably wouldn't be, it certainly wouldn't be Las Vegas, because Formula One seems to be really invested in that.
Yeah. So it's maybe, a great track. Also, I think the novelty of insane, extreme slipstream is something that was underappreciated. I tried to predict it, but I don't know if anyone remembers, but it's just it's the combination of insanely long straights, but also cold temperatures. Remember, density increases as if you increase the density, you'll increase the drag, and therefore you increase the drag effect. So the slipstream is going to be stronger when it's cold. So you go to crazy long straights at Las Vegas and cold temperatures. I mean, that's going to be amazing.
Yeah, that was a fantastic race.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was great. All right, Bryson, thank you so much for doing this. This was awesome, dude. I had a great time. Where can people find you online if they want to follow you and hear more of your thoughts on Formula One?
I'm not quite as available online now because of the nature of a new job that I have. I'm working almost all the time during the week. So I'm not quite as active as I have been, but I'm primarily on Twitter/X. I do have an Instagram presence, but I'm mostly just talking to friends there. But in terms of anything I see as technical that I think is worth noting, or I'm focused on photography now a little bit, I sometimes will share discussions about photography. I'm at X at Natural Paradigm, and that's where I'll mostly be.
You guys already know it from this conversation, but Bryson is an excellent follow on Twitter. He's underselling himself. So if you guys enjoyed this conversation, make sure to go follow him, because he's tweeting about Formula One and talking about Formula One all the time. And he does some really excellent stuff. So Bryson, thanks so much for doing this, and we'll have to do it again soon.
All right. Thank you.